Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we are continuing our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. This will be part two. We're going to be speaking with Bay Area, California resident Danny Sheehan. We're going to continue with our series on the masters of wealth and their history of influence over this nation and the influence they have on regime changes around the world. In the first part last week, Danny laid out the people who are really the power brokers, laid out the law firm that is the most powerful law firm in American history and its client list, including the Rockefellers and the Harrimans, the people who were the great robber baron families of the 19th century, and two brothers, the Dulles brothers, and how they both ended up powerful positions, one heading the CIA, one heading as Secretary of State, and they work for this law firm, an investment firm, and how what they wanted they put into motion, and they had the influence to cause everything they wanted to happen. Today we are continuing with that because many individuals believe that we are in a crisis, a serious crisis in the United States today. One of those individuals was a part of the Reagan administration. He was Undersecretary of the Treasury, Professor Paul Craig Roberts. First, let me say hello to Danny Sheehan. Nice to have you back with us today, Danny.
Good morning. Good morning, Gary. I'm delighted to be here.
Are you familiar with Paul Craig Roberts?
Sure, I am. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This is what he has to say, and I believe that this lays the foundation for our discussion. Americans, a conquered people, the new serfs. Quote, neither political party is capable of doing anything whatsoever about helping Americans. The optimism that I see is that the public support of outsiders is an indication that the public is waking up. But Americans will have to do more than wake up, as they cannot rescue themselves via the voting booth. In my opinion, the American people remain serfs until they wake up to revolution. Today, Americans exist as a conquered people. They have lost the Bill of Rights, the amendments to the Constitution that protect their liberty. Anyone other than the 1% and their political and legal servants can be picked up without charges and detained indefinitely as during the Dark Ages, when government was unaccountable and no one had any rights. Only those with power were safe. In America today, anyone not politically protected can be declared associated with terrorism and taken out by a Hellfire missile from a drone on the basis of a list of human targets drawn up by the president's advisors. Due process, guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, no longer exists in the United States of America. Neither does the constitutional prohibition against the government spying on citizens without just cause and a court warrant. The First Amendment itself, whose importance was emphasized by our founding fathers by making it the First Amendment, is no longer protected by the corrupt Supreme Court. The nine who comprise the Supreme Court, like the rest of the bought and paid-for government, serve only the 1%. Truth-tellers have become an enemy of the state. Whistleblowers are imprisoned despite their legal protection in U.S. law. The United States government has unaccountable power. Its power is not accountable to the U.S. statutory law, to international law, to the Congress, to the judiciary, to the American people, or to the moral conscience. In the 21st century, the war criminal U.S. government has murdered, maimed, and dislocated millions of people based upon lies and propaganda. Washington has destroyed seven countries in whole or part in order to enrich the American elite and comply with the neoconservative drive for U.S. world hegemony. Americans live in a propaganda-fabricated world in which a brutal police state is cloaked in nice words like freedom and democracy. Freedom and democracy is what Washington's war machine brings with sanctions, bombs, no-fly zones, troops, and drones to countries that dare to cling to their independence from Washington's hegemony. Only two countries armed with strong military capability and nuclear weapons, Russia and China, stand between Washington and Washington's goal of conquering the entire world. All of Europe, both Western, Eastern, and Southern, the British Pacific, such as Australia and New Zealand, Japan, and other parts of Asia, are vassal states of Washington's empire. None of these allegedly sovereign countries have an independent voice or an independent foreign or economic policy. All of Latin America is subject to Washington's control. No reformist government in Latin America has ever survived Washington's disapproval of putting the interests of the domestic population ahead of America's corporate and financial profits. Already this year, Washington has overthrown the female presidents of Argentina and Brazil. Washington is currently in the process of overthrowing the governments in Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia. Waiting in the wings are more. In 2009, Hillary Clinton and Obama overthrew the government of Honduras, an old Washington habit. As Washington pays the UN bills, the UN is complicit and compliant. No hand is ever raised against Washington. So why does anyone on the face of the earth think that an American election can change anything or mean anything? We know that Hillary is a liar, a crook, an agent for the 1%, and a warmonger. Trump is not their compliant person yet, but we are not optimistic. Elections are an unlikely means of restoring government that is unaccountable to the people rather than to the 1%. End quote, Professor Paul Craig Roberts. Now, I lay that out because there have been other times in American history where there have been concerned, progressive individuals who believed that if we simply educated the American public, told them the truth about who was in power, what they were doing with that power, how the media was complicit in keeping the public from being fully informed, that change would be possible. It wasn't. And partly because what you laid out last week are continuing today and hopefully will continue in the future, and that is to show us the truth. Give it to us as you are unique in your capacity to do so. So here's where I'd like you to begin, please. For those who did not catch last week's program and have not downloaded it yet, you talked about the Dulles brothers, Brown Harriman, this investment firm that was the most powerful in American history and would literally dwarf Goldman Sachs today based upon the value of the dollar when it was founded and the amount of assets under control. The amount of people that it had, the wealthy, famous people who were complicit, they were friends, they worked together, and yet each one had its own dynasty that they were protecting. All this was done behind closed doors. One of the people who were originally in their good favor was John F. Kennedy, and because of Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, actually being complicit with this ultra 1%. And he thought, they thought, the father thought Kennedy would follow along and go along. He did, then he didn't. And along with his brothers, they were assassinated. It is your contention that this unique, hidden group were responsible for it. You even postulated that the person behind this was a Theodore Shackley, the most decorated person in CIA history, who just died in, I believe it was 2002, and you believe he may also have been complicit with 9/11. More on that later. So today, I'd like for you to talk about, give us a brief overview of how this group have literally not just infiltrated U.S. democracy, but literally control all of our democracy in Washington, New York, the media. They have think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations and others that you'll mention. And then look today back, and we'll start with some seminal events, including the Vietnam War. Is it your contention that this group had an interest in creating the Vietnam War, sold the war to the public, caused the Gulf of Tonkin resolution to be passed, which was a false flag operation? What were their motives? Who was involved? How did they conduct it? Give us, as you do, the names, the dates, the best you can, to show as example how they were so powerful, they created a war, they benefited from the war, they got away with it. There hasn't been a single editorial that I have read since then, not even Rampart's or Atlantic Monthly or Harper's, that have called this group out for them being complicit in this and others. That's where we'll begin. The forum is yours.
Well, it is unfortunately true that it is something that I was totally unaware of until I ended up, as I just mentioned last week, that I ended up getting to be invited to join the most powerful litigation law firm on Wall Street at the time, in 1970, coming out of Harvard Law School, the Goodwin, Cahill, Gordon, Sonnet, Rindell, and Ohl. And I ended up being there because I had initiated the case as the one of the two founding members of the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review. We initiated the case that established the right of journalists to protect their confidential news sources. It went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So I was at the Cahill firm that represented NBC, because it was an NBC journalist that we actually filed the case for when I was at Harvard Law School. I got recruited and I was there, and for that reason, I was the one that received the call from Jim Goodell, who was chief counsel for the New York Times when they obtained the Pentagon Papers. He called my office in 1971, June of 71, and then came to the office early in the morning before everyone else arrived and told me and Floyd Abrams, our partner, and Gene Shiman, that they had gotten the papers. And I happened to be the one in the meeting that recommended publishing them and insisted upon it. And we ended up, the firm ended up supporting that. And so I got to read all 47 volumes of the Pentagon Papers, and we were in the process of deciding which portions of these are going to get published on the front page of the New York Times, and started publishing them on June 13th of 1971, when I received the telephone call from Whitney North Seymour, the U.S. attorney in New York, telling us that they were going to go in front of the federal court and get an injunction against us. So I was there intensely reading through these documents. So that's where I first began to discover that there was a massive political assassination program going on in Vietnam, that the Bay of Tonkin resolution was based upon a complete lie. It was absolutely clear, right, inside the internal telegrams that were part of the papers, the Pentagon Papers, which was an internal study, a top-secret internal study originated by the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, inside the Pentagon. And we ended up getting our hands on it through Daniel Ellsberg. And we were, as lawyers, reviewing this to try to determine whether or not this was clear evidence of criminality on the part of the administrations, in plural, and it was. So because of that, the law firm agreed to start publishing them and giving the authorization to the New York Times to go forward. And we did. So I was, at that time, you know, a young 25-year-old lawyer, and getting to read these horrendous internal documents showing that they knew perfectly well what they were doing, that they had lied, that they, in 1954, when I tracked it back through the documents, that at the end of World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, as they were approaching the end of World War II, he very much did not want the French to be able to go back into Indochina. They had come into Indochina in the 1890s at that same time of that huge robber baron operation in the United States, the imperial activities of countries around the world, the British, you know, going into India, the Dutch going in, and the Boers going into South Africa, that whole period when the United States was taking over the Philippine Islands and Hawaii and Cuba and South America, that what happened is the French went into Indochina, and they were driven out by the Japanese in World War II. So at the end of World War II, and when the people of Indochina were hoping to be liberated with the Japanese being defeated, the French wanted to come back in, and Roosevelt was opposing it. But what happened is they ended up coming back in, the French, because Roosevelt died, you know, on April 12th of 1945, and Truman came in and didn't support the position of Roosevelt. French came back in. The Indochinese rose up under Ho Chi Minh, drove them out, surrounded them at Nguyen Binh Phu in 1954, and General Giap was massacring the French. And they stopped and said, look, we're going to give the French a chance to leave. They have to withdraw below, I think it was the 38th parallel. And if they will, then we'll let them leave, but under no circumstances can anybody consider this any kind of a boundary line. And the French withdrew, signed the treaties in Paris, and immediately Richard Nixon, who was chairing the 5412 Committee of the National Security Council as the vice president under Eisenhower, recommended that what they do is they try to treat that like a separate country. And they actually flew in Neo Din Diem out of Columbia University. He was a graduate student at Columbia University, flew him into the southern area of Vietnam and declared the country to be a separate republic and started sending in military advisors. And all of this information was laid out inside the Pentagon Papers, the individual cable traffic, the internal memos. It was all there. And so I was stunned, actually. I mean, I had come out of a little town up in the northern Adirondack Mountains of New York, was fortunate to get a big scholarship to go to Harvard College and Harvard Law School, and so I came out being more or less naive like everybody else at that time. You know, I was extremely troubled by the assassination of President Kennedy, which had happened just when I was a freshman in college. I knew something was wrong there. I knew we were being lied to by the Warren Commission. And I knew that this was terrible, whatever was going on in Vietnam, but I didn't know the details until I got to personally see all 47 volumes of these top secret cables. And the most astonishing one was the one about the Bay of Tonkin, where they knew perfectly well that there was no attack on our, there were two ships, the USS Henry Knox, another one. They were actually firing big guns, 12-inch guns, into the shoreline of Vietnam. They were all within a mile and a half of the shoreline, and there was some activity on the shore to try to figure out what to do about these people. And there were a couple boats that were trying to figure out if they could go out and try to get in between the shelling and the shoreline. And that was what they falsely portrayed as PT boats, you know, launching torpedoes at the ships. Now, turns out my brother was on the USS Henry Knox, so he knows perfectly well that it was a big fat lie. But it turns out that it said in the documents that it was a fat lie. And Lyndon Johnson said, look, let's treat this as though we were fired upon and treat it as an act of war against us. Let's say that we were out on the high seas and completely outside of the three-mile limit, which was a total lie. We're engaged in no hostilities toward the shoreline, which was a total lie. And let's say that they attacked us unprovoked. I mean, can you imagine that? This tiny little country that had just gotten out from under the French was somehow attacking United States warships. It was absurd on the face of it. But they said, here, let's use this as a rationale for going in. And Lyndon Johnson ended up sending in eventually 500,000 United States military forces to try to establish a land base in Southeast Asia. So I was astonished by that, and I was inside the law firm, and it was a big and powerful law firm, so I was hoping we were going to be able to do other things to help. For example, I was hoping we were going to be able to represent Daniel Ellsberg in his criminal trial and basically put all of this stuff onto the record in the criminal case. But the law firm refused to do it. Actually, the senior partner at Cahill Gordon, Lawrence McKay said to me to my face, he said, well, it's one thing to represent the New York Times for $1 million fee in front of the United States Supreme Court. It's another thing entirely to represent a traitor. That's what he said. I couldn't believe it. So I ended up, because I had written most of the memos, because I'd come off the Harvard Law Review. I was the one that first insisted upon publishing the papers in the meeting with Jim Goodell and Floyd Abrams and Gene Shimon. I was the one that was writing the briefs that we were doing in front of the Supreme Court, along with several other people. But I was flabbergasted that he was going to call Dan Ellsberg a traitor. So I gathered up the memos that I had written personally, made copies of them, and then brought them over to Leonard Bodine of Rabinowitz, Bodine, and Standard that were deciding to defend Ellsberg. And the firm was furious at me for having done that because they didn't want to be associated with representing someone whom they, as the senior partners, considered to be traitors. So they told me that I'd be happier elsewhere, and ended up terminating me from the firm. Actually told me that I was the second person ever terminated from the Cahill firm. The only other one was Alger Hiss. So I said, oh, look at the strange company I find myself in here. Yeah, but I got recruited immediately to go to the law firm of F. Lee Bailey, because Bailey had been trying to get me to come there from the time I was the editor of the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review. So I went over to there, and we were doing the Watergate burglary, representing James McCord, the CIA wiretapping specialist,
Danny, who was caught in the hotel. Danny, I want to bring it back for a moment. I need you to do a little more encapsulation here. Can you pull back the picture and tell us who you believe or had evidence was behind the Vietnam War? What were our motives outside of helping the French? Were there industrialists? Were there oil interests? Who were the people that we never heard about, to this day don't know were involved in Vietnam? Tell us the untold story of Vietnam.
The basic bottom line is there had been a group inside the American elite for many years that were known as the China Lobby. This is a group of people that were headed up by a man by the name of William D. Pauley. William D. Pauley was the head. He was the guy that helped put together the Flying Tigers that actually were flying over into Indochina before World War II. And bringing military supplies in against them. They ended up setting up a company that was called International Commerce, the International Commerce Corporation. The International Commerce Corporation, from the end of World War II in 1945, were the recipients of a portion of the heroin trafficking profits that were being smuggled in from Southeast Asia, the Golden Triangle, through the French Corsican Mafia, turning it into heroin and smuggling it into Cuba, into Havana. And the dictator of Cuba, Batista, Julio Batista, was business partners with Santos Traficante, the head of the Mafia, the Don of the Mafia in Havana, and a man called Paul Helliwell. Paul Helliwell ran a company by the name of the Sea Supply Corporation, SEA, standing for Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia Supply Company. What he was doing is he was receiving the profits coming in from the heroin sales, purchasing military equipment, arms and explosives, and sending them in through the International Commerce Corporation, owned by William Pauley, the kind of the leader of the China lobby, who thought that the most important thing that we could do was establish control over Southeast Asia to get access to the China markets. That was what they were trying to do. And William Pauley was a close personal friend of Alan Dulles, who was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and in fact was the legal counsel for Brown Brothers Harriman, the private investment firm, the CEO of which was George Herbert Walker, who was the grandfather of George Herbert Walker Bush. And in fact, when George Herbert Walker went over to found the Union Bank of New York to help fund the rise of the Third Reich in Germany, he appointed his son-in-law, Prescott Bush, to be the new CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman. These people all saw the future of the United States to be going toward China into Southeast Asia. They're the ones that were supportive of the taking over the Philippines, the Hawaiian Islands, moving out toward China. This began under John W. Foster, who was the Secretary of State in 1893. He was the grandfather of John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. So this is a family, the Dulleses and the Fosters, that in fact dominated the Secretary of State positions. There was John W. Foster, then his son-in-law, Robert Lansing, who had married his oldest daughter, became the Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson knew exactly what was happening, that these people who he said, actually, a quote from Woodrow Wilson, which I have committed to memory, was Woodrow Wilson, when he knew about what his Secretary of State was doing, Robert Lansing, he said, "An invisible empire has been set up within our nation, above all the forms of democracy, a power so organized, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete and so pervasive that some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of government know that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of this group. Okay, now that's what he said in 1913. Okay, and he said, the liberty of democracy is not safe if our people tolerate the growth of private power to such a point that it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. In essence, he said, is fascism, the ownership of the government by a tiny group of wealthy individuals and their corporations. Okay, and that was said by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1934. Okay, and then he went on to say, Franklin Roosevelt went on to say in a speech on October 31st, 1936 in Madison Square Garden during his campaign for re-election in 1936, he said, quote, this is Roosevelt. I remember these quotes because I teach it at the University of California. He said, we must struggle against these enemies of peace, these owners of business and financial monopolies, financial speculators, and the men in charge of reckless banking practices and war profiteering. These forces have come to consider our American government to be nothing more than a mere appendage of their private business affairs. We must beware that our government is being run by the interest of organized wealth. This is just as dangerous as if our government were being run by an organized crime syndicate. Never before in all of our history have these forces been so united as they are today. This concentration of corporate power and private wealth is seriously impairing the effectiveness of our American economic system to provide adequate employment opportunities for our people, or to provide adequate capital to smaller businesses. In short, this concentration of power is impairing our American government from being able to assure an equitable distribution of income and earnings among the people of our nation. And he went on to say on June 27th of 1936 in his speech at the Democratic National Convention. Now here we are approaching the Democratic National Convention of 2016. In this convention in 1936. Franklin Roosevelt, in his speech before the Democratic Convention, said this. He said, it is entirely to be expected that these privileged princes of these new corporate economic dynasties, thirsting for power and private profit, as we know they do, would reach out to seek control over our government itself. They have indeed now done this and have created a new despotism, which they have wrapped in the robes of legal sanctions. Into their service, these modern mercenaries have sought now to draft our people, our labor, and all of our property. We now face a financial and industrial dictatorship in which the political equality that we once believed we had finally won in our revolution has now become meaningless in the face of this new degree of economic inequality. A very small group of extremely wealthy and politically powerful men have now successfully concentrated into their own personal hands almost complete control over our people's property, over our people's money, over our people's labor, and over our people's lives. For too many of us, our lives are no longer free. Our liberty is no longer real, for we are no longer free to pursue our own happiness in the face of these men's economic tyranny. These economic royalists complain that we are seeking to overthrow a sacred American institution of capitalism, but what they are really complaining about is that we seek to break their economic and political power over our nation. Allegiance to our Constitution requires that we overthrow this power. It is in vain for these men to seek to hide behind our American flag and the Constitution. For in their blindness, they have forgotten what our flag and our American Constitution actually stand for. Now, as always, they stand for democracy, not for the tyranny of the few, for freedom, not for subjugation by the wealthy, and against any form of dictatorship of the overprivileged few. We must remain ever aware of the fact that this tiny group of extremely wealthy and selfish men will again and again seek to clip the wings of our American eagle for the purpose of feathering their own private financial nest. Okay? Now, that's what Franklin Roosevelt was talking about.
80 years ago.
That's
80
right.
years ago. And Danny, so let's summarize for a moment, just so we encapsulate this thought. If I understand you, you're saying that the elite, this small group of people, and I'd like for you in a moment to go through the names of the companies and the names of the families, so at least we see who they are, were then, and who they are today. What are their banks, companies, insurance companies today? They decided that their market, purely for profit, was Southeast Asia.
That's right.
China was the big market, and they needed to stay in Vietnam.
That's right.
And so therefore, they did not honor the treaty that was signed with the French and to get out with the Vietnamese. And at that time, Ho Chi Minh wanted to actually come to the United States using our Constitution as a basis for Vietnam's new constitution.
Right.
Is that not correct?
Right. That's absolutely right.
And
he wanted to have a democracy, an American-style democracy there in Southeast Asia.
And yet all the people portrayed him as being a demon, and that's what we generally do when we want to destroy someone's country. Now, so you're showing us that it was all about this group of people, and that's what the real interest was, and anything they had to do it. They had the power of the over the President of the United States and any other politician. They falsified the Gulf of Tonkin. That is absolutely a matter of historical fact today that is not in dispute.
Nope.
And then we lost. America, by the way, lost over 50,000 dead. We had over 250,000 wounded. The Vietnamese had over 3 million dead,
that's right.
A legacy that has continued to this day. That's good. At least we know what that was really about and not what we were told that rewrites history for us. Now, I want you to hear what President Kennedy had to say, but he never said who these people were. I want you to hear just 2 minutes of this.
Yes.
In his own words, President John F. Kennedy, just before he was assassinated, and do you believe he was actually mentioning the group that you're talking about and that FDR was talking about? Let's listen to John F. Kennedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned. No rumor is printed. No secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program. For from that scrutiny comes understanding. And from that understanding comes support or opposition. And both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people.
Danny,
I have complete confidence.
Danny, your thoughts on that. Who was he talking about?
Well, the key thing that we discovered is that right at the end of World War II, when Reinhard Gehlen, the commander of the Third Reich's anti-Soviet and anti-Eastern Bloc intelligence, turned himself in to the 101st Counterintelligence Corps in Germany and offered to become the head of anti-Soviet and anti-communist intelligence for the Allied nations, that he came to Washington, D.C., actually to Fort Hunt, just outside of Washington, D.C., and spent 3 weeks there negotiating with the very end of the OSS, the Office of Special Services, and the Counterintelligence Corps, and offered to provide the services of 100 of his men who ran the anti-Soviet intelligence for the Third Reich, if in fact the American government would agree to take their names off the Nuremberg War Crime Tribunal list, and that they would set up an operation in Germany, and they would set up this operation to run the anti-Soviet, anti-communist intelligence for the Western Allies. And in fact, they began doing that. And they set up in the translator for Reinhard Gehlen in those meetings at Fort Hunt was a man by the name of Theodore G. Shackley, an American boy whose parents had come from Poland and Germany. He was a fluent German speaker. He was in the Counterintelligence Corps, the 101st Counterintelligence Corps. He served as the translator for Reinhard Gehlen and came with him to those meetings at Fort Hunt. And he became extraordinarily powerful. He was actually assigned to go back and serve as the deputy to Reinhard Gehlen in Germany at the end of World War II. And they set up a group in Germany, in Berlin, a base of the OSS people. Bill Harvey was in charge of that operation. David Morales was a man that was there. David Atlee Phillips was a man who was there. They were at that place, and the governor general, who was made the governor general of Germany to administer them after World War II, was a man by the name of John J. McCloy. And this John J. McCloy was, very importantly, one of three men, the other two of whom were senior partners in Brown Brothers Harriman, a man by the name of Robert Lovett and a man by the name of Robert B. Anderson. They had been made the trustees of a $1.2 trillion trust fund that had been set up by taking the gold and silver and jewels and platinum out of 12 troves that they found in the Philippines, where the Japanese had buried these troves of treasure. And at the end of the war, they took these and they put them not into the United States' hands, not into the hands of the Secretary of State, but put them in the hands of the private trust that was run by Brown Brothers Harriman. And one of the third person in this, other than the two senior partners in Brown Brothers Harriman, Robert Lovett and Robert B. Anderson, was John J. McCloy. He was made the Governor General of Germany for the United States. And they ran this thing called the Berlin Operating Base out of there. And there's a group of guys they call the Boys from Berlin, the B.O.B., the Boys from Bob, are what they're nicknamed within the intelligence community. And these people, Theodore Shackley, was there serving as the direct deputy to Reinhard Gehlen. And what they did is they set up in Bavaria, in the mountains of Bavaria, at a place called Oberammergau. They set up an anti-communist special warfare training academy. And for the next 10 years, out of all of the American allied nations, at the end of World War II, they took young men and they brought them to this base and they trained them. They trained them in what they considered to be, quote, anti-communist special warfare techniques. But in fact, they were fascists. That the commander of that base, appointed by Reinhard Gehlen, was a man by the name of Otto Skorzeny. Otto Skorzeny was the head of the Waffen-SS Special Forces, and he was put in charge of training those men. Theodore Shackley was sent to that school, and he was trained by those fascists. And he, in fact, Theodore Shackley, was also brought to the United States and was a member of the inaugural class of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was trained by the Central Intelligence Agency and then sent back to Germany to serve as the deputy to Reinhard Gehlen. And so this nest of people that were there in Germany, and Alan Dulles was there. Alan Dulles had become very close to the German state because he served, in addition to his serving as the legal counsel for Brown Brothers Harriman, he served as the legal counsel to Germany to negotiate the payment of the Versailles Treaty war reparations for them that had been set up in the Versailles Treaty in 1919. In fact, I mentioned last week, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles are the ones who authored the reparations requirements in the Treaty of Versailles. They were appointed to the drafting team by their uncle, Robert Lansing, who was the Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson. And so this guy, Alan Dulles, was there in Germany. Bill Harvey was there in Germany. John J. McCloy was there in Germany. Theodore Shackley was there in Germany. David Atlee Phillips was there. David Morales was there. This is a nest of people that were undoubtedly fascists. And Theodore Shackley became the operations chief for these guys because he was trained at the Anti-Communist Special Warfare Training Academy by Otto Skorzeny. And he became an extraordinarily powerful and important person because Alan Dulles, behind the scenes, was the man who made the strategic plans working with his clients in Brown Brothers Harriman, who were these major industrialists, the same people that were being talked about by Franklin Roosevelt in his speech at the Democratic National Convention on June 27th of 1936. This is the group. Theodore Shackley was their operations chief, and Alan Dulles, who became the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, was the guy who was liaisoning to all of these powerful, wealthy industrialists to get the green light for what policies they wanted to do. And Theodore Shackley was the operations chief in the field. And you follow the career of Theodore Shackley, and he was brought from being the deputy to Reinhard Gehlen immediately after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. Because John Kennedy, whom we're talking about here today, when, as you mentioned, John Kennedy had actually been to Germany between the summer of his junior and his senior year at Harvard College, he went to Germany with his father, Joseph Kennedy, Joseph P. Kennedy, and he went there because he went to go to Rome for the inauguration of Pope Pius the XII, Pope Pius the XII, who is a fascist, was a fascist, who was deeply involved in helping to sneak out the German SS officers and the leadership of the fascist party, the Nazi party in Germany, to sneak them out of Europe into South America, into Argentina and Brazil and Uruguay and Paraguay and Chile. And they got 1,000 men out of Europe, the top ranking men in the Nazi party, in the SS, and moved them down into South America. And John Kennedy went with his father in 1936 over to Germany for the inauguration, and then John Kennedy went to Germany and actually wrote in his diary. I've got the pages of his diary, copies of them in my file, that where he said, "Oh, I think this is a great idea. This new theory of wedding together the corporate power with the state is just what Germany needs, and I think this fellow Hitler is doing a good job at this." So the people who were part of this cabal, one of whom was Joseph P. Kennedy, had reason to believe that Kennedy, if he were allowed to ascend to the presidency in 1960, would in fact be an ally of theirs. And indeed he was. He started out by agreeing to allow more military advisors to be sent into Vietnam. He was kind of open to this whole thing until he started to realize that once he was in the presidency, the demands that these people were making upon him included having to launch a military strike against Cuba. And so when he came into office on January 21st of 1961, after having been elected on November 4th of 1960 over Richard Nixon, he came into office and discovered that there was this plan afoot to actually launch a U.S. military invasion against Cuba. They were going to use just a handful of anti-Castro Cuban exiles that had fled from Cuba in January of 1959 after Batista had been overthrown by Fidel Castro and Raul Castro and Che Guevara and others. They had fled to Florida, and they had become involved under Richard Nixon, who was the chair of the 5412 Committee of the National Security Council, overseeing covert operations under Eisenhower, that they ran a thing called Operation 40 against Cuba, of just blowing up bridges and lighting fire to sugar plantations and things like that. But Richard Nixon planned that when he was elected president, which he hoped to be in November of 1960, that when he came into office in January of 61, he was going to have a cadre of some 400 of these Cuban exiles land on the beaches at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba and raise a flag. And they were going to give out this code word that is going to say, the fish is red, the fish is red. That was their code word. I've been deep into this stuff. I've talked to men who were involved in this directly. And Richard Nixon was then going to send the United States Marines in behind them and overthrow the government of Fidel Castro and establish a military dictatorship in Cuba. But when John Kennedy was elected, surprisingly, to Nixon, and he came to office, he said, look, if you guys are going to go do this and put these 400 men in, if you're telling me, which Alan Dulles was telling him, along with Richard Bissell, his deputy, in Charles Cabal, were all telling him, he said, look, if the Cuban people are going to rise up behind these 400 people when they land on the beach and declare a republic, then fine, I'll take your word for it, but we're not going to supply any air cover, we're not going to allow the Marines to back you up. You know, I'm going to take you at your word. But what happened is they landed on the beach, and people don't realize this, but they screwed up. I talked to the pilots. They had a number of airplanes based in Nicaragua. They were going to come in and provide air cover for them, and they screwed up, and they were an hour late because of the time change in the two time zones. And so the air cover didn't come in. They got trapped on the beach. And so what happened is Alan Dulles and Bissell and the other guys came to John Kennedy at an event that he had scheduled at the White House, a big social event, so that he could be just, you know, dancing with other people when the invasion was taking place so he could pretend he wasn't involved in it. And they came to him and brought him into a back room and said, look, this is a disaster. They've been caught on the beaches. You need to send in the Marines. And it turns out, I now know, that in fact, totally contrary to Kennedy's orders, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that was under Lemenser, the Chief of the Army was Lemenser, Chief of the Air Force was Curtis LeMay, in the Navy was there, and what they did is they ordered the United States Marines on board Navy vessels to be standing offshore at Cuba. They had a whole armada of U.S. military ships filled with U.S. Marines waiting to invade Cuba, directly contrary to the President's orders. So they were acting in defiance of him, thinking they could just trap him, and that he would say, oh, out of his ego, he's not going to allow these people to be beaten on the beach. So they confronted him at this party, and they took him out into the back room and said, look, you got to give the green light to send these people in. And he was furious, and he said, absolutely not. I told you I'm not going to do this. And what happened is they had to back down. Those men were all captured, and we all know about that at the Bay of Pigs. But right then, Kennedy realized that Alan Dulles and these people in this group were going to try to defy him, and they were going to act independently of him. And so that was when he made that statement to Arthur Schlesinger. These bastards, he said, I'm going to splinter that Central Intelligence Agency into 1,000 pieces and scatter them to the winds. And he fired Alan Dulles, and he fired Bissell, and he fired Charles Cabal, got rid of them. But a very peculiar thing was done. This cabal was so powerful that what they did is the CIA moved Theodore Shackley from being in Berlin at this Berlin operating base with all these people and Bill Harvey. They brought them back into the United States, and they put Theodore Shackley in charge of the Miami station. And they went right ahead and continued these covert operations against Cuba with Kennedy's consent to the covert operations. But Theodore Shackley was the guy in charge of that group. And they, in fact, had within them a private assassination team that had been set up by Richard Nixon. And I touched
and
on
Howard
that last
Hughes.
Time. Yeah, and Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes and Richard Nixon. And
that's right.
The reason Watergate, you told us for the first time, no one knew this until you told us last week, that the reason Watergate actually happened was because Larry O'Brien, who was going to be the new Democratic National Chairperson, he had worked for Howard Hughes for a long time.
That's right.
And Nixon was afraid that he may have information about this Assassination 15 group, 15 professional assassins that were working under Shackley and that Howard Hughes and Nixon had put together, and that would have embarrassed him at election time, so they planted bugs in there, and it was successful. Right. The first break-in was successful, but one of the bugs didn't work, and that's when they were caught going back in to fix those bugs.
That's right.
Now we've got that. So now
you've answered my question.
But
it's important, Gary, it's important to remember to tell people that the reason that Richard Nixon was so terrified about that group being exposed, if Larry O'Brien knew about them because of his having worked for Howard Hughes, who set them up, the reason he was really terrified about that is because those are the people that assassinated President Kennedy. They are the ones that assassinated President Kennedy in Dallas in November of 1963. That same S-Force, that group of 15 anti-Castro Cuban exiles that had been formed by Richard Nixon back in 1960. And Nixon was terrified that if that came out, that he would lose the election in 1972.
Okay, so, we only have 5 minutes left. I want to get specific on if you could do real short answers.
Yep.
Was Richard Nixon aware that Kennedy was going to be assassinated?
Yes.
He was a part of it.
Yeah, he was there. He was in the meeting at 11 o'clock at night at the home of Clint Murchison in Dallas, Texas. He was there ostensibly to participate in a PepsiCo convention. Lyndon Johnson was in the meeting. J. Edgar Hoover was in the meeting. One of the Brown brothers, George Brown, was in the meeting. They were there at that meeting and the night before at 11 o'clock. And Lyndon Johnson came out of that meeting and said to his mistress, you know, after tomorrow, I'm not going to have to worry about those Kennedy brothers.
We interviewed her. She confirmed that to me also. Next, was this Theodore Shackley part of the assassination of JFK?
Yes, absolutely. He was the guy who was in charge of the Miami station out of which those guys worked. And they worked directly under E. Howard Hunt and a guy by the name of Rip Robertson.
So,
and Shackley was directly involved.
So when E. Howard Hunt was on his deathbed and confessed to his son that he was a part of this, the world just thought, well, that's not true. But now you're saying E. Howard Hunt was a part of the assassination group.
Yes, he was.
Okay. What part did he play?
He was one of the liaison for the agency. He was the guy who was the liaison to the S-Force, who the three of them that were based in the Everglades at this anti-Castro Cuban paramilitary.
So we also know that J. Edgar Hoover was part of the conspiracy.
Yes, J. Edgar Hoover also knew about it. He hated he considered John F. Kennedy to be a pervert, a strange thing for him to say.
Right.
But anyway, but he did.
Okay, now, do you know the names of any of the shooters, and how many shooters were there?
There were three shooters, and David Morales was one of them. Rafael Chichi Quintero, and a fellow by the name of Felix Rodriguez.
Were any of them, did they live after, or were they themselves killed?
No, they lived after. They lived after. In fact, what they did is they hid them out after the assassination. They hid them out inside the security department of the Mexican National Oil Company, Pemex, in Mexico City, that was the president of which was Jorge Diaz Serrano, who was a business partner of George Herbert Walker Bush in the Zapata Oil Company.
Would George Herbert Walker Bush been aware that they were going to kill the president?
That's not clear.
Okay,
that's
good. All right.
Now, but he was in Dallas. He was in Dallas, and he lied about it. He said he wasn't in Dallas that night, and he was. And we now have a record of him having been at an oil men's convention there in Dallas, and he lied about it and, in fact, made a telephone call. He fled out of Dallas and called from a place outside of the town and called into the Secret Service and reported a guy that worked in some group that he thought might do, to try to divert attention away from it. And he lied about it and said he doesn't really remember. He's one of the two people on the planet that assert that they don't remember where they were when they heard the president was killed. One of them was, in fact, George Herbert Walker Bush, and the other is Richard Nixon.
Okay, very quickly, we need short answers.
Yes.
How long did it take before Robert Kennedy knew who killed his brother?
Robert Kennedy, right that very day. That very day, when he had John McCone come over to his house in Alexandria, and he said, look, I think that your people were involved in doing this. And McCone, of course, didn't know anything. He'd been brought in to replace Alan Dulles. He was cut out from everything of this thing. But he, in fact, sent a message to Khrushchev, telling through a guy named Bill Walters. Bill Walters, a friend of his, not the basketball player, but a different guy, sent him over to Khrushchev to tell Khrushchev that Bobby Kennedy and Jackie both believed that that John had been killed by a very tiny cabal of extremely rich and powerful men in the United States, and that Bobby, for Khrushchev not to despair over this, because Bobby was going to be president soon. And that he would, in fact, get back to the same treaty that John Kennedy and Khrushchev had been working on secretly through an exchange of 18 private letters, trying to set up an nuclear missile treaty to disband all the nuclear missiles of both countries. And okay. Bobby told him that.
Final question that we'll end with today and pick it up with our next discussion. Did this same cabal kill Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, Jr.?
That I don't know about.
Okay.
Because I was directly involved in all of these other issues, directly as an attorney with subpoena power, with investigator. I never was involved in
that. Weren't you the attorney for Trafficante?
No. F. Lee Bailey was the attorney for Trafficante. We got Trafficante to tell Bad Andy Tooney, our chief investigator, about what their role had been in the Kennedy assassination and in the Watergate
but
burglary.
He was a part of the Kennedy assassination, and he told your law firm that you work with about
yes.
it, right?
Yes, he told them about
okay.
the assassination of President John Kennedy, yes.
All right. Okay, so those are the piece of the puzzle that the American media has refused to look at. You've just given us the complete picture. We will fill in more details, but I didn't have a chance to ask you about the Phoenix Project, which Shackley headed in Vietnam.
He created it.
I want to go into that. Please make yourself available so we can do a part three to continue our discussion.
Surely, absolutely.
Also, I mentioned, could you, within 30 seconds, could you mention some names of people today whose companies or whose legacy continues that we should pay attention to, or who have been a part of the sustaining legacy of this small group?
One of the most important single people for people to keep in mind, who was a deputy to Theodore Shackley when he was the associate deputy director for operations under George Bush. The guy's name is Cofer Black. Cofer Black was Theodore Shackley's deputy. He has gone private, and he worked for Blackwater. He's gone over to Blackwater, and he set up a company that's called Total Intelligence Solutions. And Cofer Black is one of the most nasty, evil men on the planet. And he is, in a sense, the progeny of Theodore Shackley. But he doesn't have the Nazi fascist connections. But he is the guy who has taken onto himself the mantle of Theodore Shackley. Cofer Black, his name is.
We will talk about more on this. Danny Sheehan, thank you very much for being a part of this series, Masters of Wealth and Their History of Influence and Those Who Control Us Behind the Scenes. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening.